This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hi, this is Allison Weir. I've been invited to interview a very interesting person and a courageous person. His name is David Weiss. I know I'm probably pronouncing that badly, so I'll ask him to correct me in a few minutes here. He is a spokesperson, he's a rabbi, for a religious group called Neturei Karta, which is a group that is very religious Jewish organization that opposes Zionism and that feels that does not recognize the state of Israel. I believe we have the rabbi on the line with us now. Is that correct, Rabbi?
Yes. This is Rabbi Weiss. This is Rabbi Yisrael David Weiss from Neturei Karta International. That's the name of the organization, which is Aramaic for protectors of the city, and for Jews united against Zionism. And with the help of the Almighty, God should help that we should be able to be good messengers of His, to be able to provide your audience with the knowledge, His knowledge, and so sanctify His name, and with God's help, bring peace to the world.
Excellent. I think I forgot. I'm sorry. I'm very new at being a radio host. I probably forgot to say who I am. My name is Allison Weir, and I'm executive director of If Americans Knew, and I'm also president of the Council for the National Interest. My background is journalism, not theology. So my role, I feel, will be mostly just asking a few questions and letting Rabbi Weiss explain to listeners the philosophy and theology of his organization and his personal history with it. So I'll start with just a simple question. I'm very glad to have the opportunity to speak to you, because I know in my research I have found, like many people have found, that most religious Jews, when political Zionism began in the late 1800s, it's quite clear that observant Jews were largely opposed to political Zionism, feeling that it was heretical and really antithetical to their religious beliefs. Do you feel that is accurate? And can you explain to us a bit more about that?
Yeah, again, with the help of the Almighty. And first of all, thank you. Thank the program for having me on. We're humbled and privileged. It's an honor, and thank you for being the gracious host we are. And I've met you. I know that you work tirelessly against Zionism and not against Judaism, as of course the supporters of Zionism would like to dismiss everybody as being anti-Semitic, and that's repugnant. But we'll get into that with God's help. But basically, as you say, right at the beginning, when the concept, the ideology of Zionism was broached, when they came along with this idea, the movers and shakers of this idea were almost entirely anti-religious. They were very estranged from religion. They were not religious Jews, as anybody who follows the lives of Theodor Herzl and Jabotinsky and Ben Gurion and all the others who were from Zionism. They were people their personal lives, as I say, they were very far removed from religion, and they detested the religion in their own writings. We'll get again with God's help. I will speak about that. But the ideology itself that they were creating was an ideology that is totally antithetical to Judaism, that's contradictory to Judaism, because what is Judaism? Judaism is the concept of the covenant that the Jewish people made around 3,000 years ago on Mount Sinai to be subservient to the Almighty by as in the Torah, it states that God approached the Jewish people. Right. Okay, so basically the idea, the Judaism was, like I say, a covenant. God said that you should, to the Jewish people, you should be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kodesh, it says in the goy kodesh. That means a kingdom of priests and the holy nation, meaning that according to the Jewish religion, any human being, we believe the whole world and was the universe, everything was created by God, and everybody is required to serve him. They're created by God, and we're here to serve him. And if you don't have to be Jewish at all, you don't have to be able to serve God. And we have from Elijah the prophet in his book called Tana Dvei Yo, and in our law books, that anybody who upholds the seven commandments of Noah was the father of all creations. It was Adam and Eve, and then Neph was the great flood, and Neph was everybody descended from Noah. So it's just the world. So it's called the laws of Noah, being that we're all descendants from Noah, that everybody has to uphold seven commandments, meaning to believe in one God, not to commit adultery, not to kill, not to steal, not to not to serve idol worshipery. And then also to have a court system in every country where you're residing, and also not to eat from an animal while it's still shaking, even if it's slaughtered. So basically, if one opposes these laws, then he's a righteous individual. He is considered a righteous individual. He will inherit the world to come, we say, which will be, you know, God's the whole universe and all of time. That anybody in that case will inherit the world to come. You do not have to be Jewish to serve God. In fact, we discourage people from becoming Jewish, from adopting Judaism or converting to Judaism, because in Judaism there's two concepts. So first of all, the Judaism means that we went under this covenant 3,000 years ago, where we accepted to be a kingdom of priests. And as it, when what priesthood, as anybody and everybody understands, means that you're constantly given over to worship, the worship of God, which is, we have in the covenant is 613 commandments that it states in the Torah, and that means that we're basically busy all day, 7 days a week. We live a life, you know, we eat, a physical life also. I mean that we have to eat and sleep and so forth and rest and the basic. But everything, we're very busy to that we have many requirements, and that our life, as I say, is encompassed. We're required to study the Torah constantly, as we call the people of the book. So we have to do this 7 days a week and 24 hours a day, basically. You know, so therefore, if anybody decides to become a Jew, then he's putting himself under a tremendous obligation of being like a priest. And if he doesn't uphold this covenant, then he'll be considered a sinner. So we discourage people from doing that. It's like, I always try to give an example. It's like somebody to accept upon himself, he's going to do exercise, and he buys himself an expensive treadmill and all the other trappings. And then after a week, he loses that will to do it. So, but if in Judaism, once a person converts to Judaism, if he doesn't follow the rules, there's no such thing as regrets or retraction. He's a full Jew. And therefore, he's considered a sinner for when he's not upholding the Torah. So we discourage, while if he's not a Jewish and he upholds the seven commandments of Noah, then he's he will inherit the world to come. He's not sinning. So we discourage that. Secondly, because there's the concept of anti-Semitism, that a person is, if he becomes Jewish, we believe that God makes everything happen, whether it's a tsunami or an earthquake or anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is something, in other words, we believe is from God to remind us that we should remember we're not here for all forever. We're here temporarily on this earth, and we shouldn't cement ourselves into the materialistic issues. And so God gives us a reminder, and so throughout history, people were, there was trials and tribulations, Jews were attacked, there were pogroms and so forth. So we believe it's from God. Now, I'm making a disclaimer. I'm saying now that clearly that when Zionism comes along and they state, oh, it's because of anti-Semitism that they are bringing upon themselves the wrath of people for doing a terrible crime. So we're talking about anti-Semitism that was where Jewish communities were serving God and being what they were supposed to be, a light unto the nations, practicing Judaism. Still and all, there was attacks against them, vicious attacks. So therefore, being that this we believe is from God, and God is like anything good and bad, everything we believe ultimately is from God, is the will of the Almighty. And, of course, the ones who perpetrate the evils against others, or let's say anti-Semitic attacks against Jews, even though it's from God to remind us, but they will be punished, for instance, like the Nazis and so forth. I don't want to get off on too many tangents. So basically, the issue is that therefore we discourage people. Let me just finish this concept. So therefore, basically, we discourage people from becoming, from accepting Judaism. That said, Judaism is something which is a very holy thing. It's that we accepted the covenant of 613 commandments 3,000 years ago. And Jews upheld that throughout history. We went into part of the covenant was that we should go, when we were released from slavery and bondage in Egypt, that we had to go up to the Holy Land. It was the will of God, but God stipulated with us that we have to be on a very high level of holiness to be in His Holy Land. In this land, God is ruler of the whole world, but the Holy Land we believe is like God's garden. So basically, the Jews were warned by all the prophets, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, and all that. That if we're not being on the proper level, then we will be driven from the land. And with the destruction of the temple, King Solomon's temple, the other temple, we were driven from the land around 2,000 years ago. Since then, we were put under oath by God that we are not to make any attempt to return as a nation. We are not to make any, we were put under three oaths, stringent oaths, like commandments. Oaths is even more stringent than the regular commandments, which is that we should not return in mass, in large numbers. As individuals, if the countries that, you know, the rulers of the ruling country allows us to be there, whatever the ruling party is, then we can stay there as individuals, but not as a nation, and we should not return en masse to the Holy Land. Secondly, we are not to rebel against any nations. We have to be loyal citizens in every country we're residing. And thirdly, we're not to make any attempt to end this decree of exile, which was given by God, even though it was carried out by the Romans and the Greeks and so forth. But we are in exile by the decree of God, and therefore we are not to make any attempts to end it, because we believe it's like a medicine of God. You know, like a medicine is bitter, but it accomplishes its purpose. The child doesn't want to take it, but the parent has to give it because it's absolutely necessary. So that's what it is. The exile of 2,000 years already is a decree of God, and Jews respected it and accepted it, and for 2,000 years we never attempted to breach these oaths of God. What we do is we are waiting patiently for the day God is totally compassionate, and we believe one day He will make a metaphysical change. That means without any human intervention, there will be a spirit around the world where all humanity will recognize that there is one God. The concept of atheism will stop. Everybody will believe in one God, and then we believe, and we say it in our prayers constantly, that the nations will all gather together, and we will go up to serve God. And then that is what we pray constantly and yearn for this concept of the ending of exile, where all humanity will recognize one God, and God Himself will rebuild the third temple. So we were never a threat for other nations, for the Muslims or anybody, because we clearly are not to make any endeavors or, you know, strive to create any nationhood or anything like that. You know, like this concept of a Jewish sovereignty, because it's forbidden for us. So we were never considered a threat. We have totally, and we definitely have a distinct difference in our religious beliefs, although we are very, you know, we are similar in the fact that we believe in one God, and we were able to reside in Muslim countries, but because they respected, and, you know, we have very close issues as far as that goes, you know, to believe in one God. But to the concept of creating a state, that's clearly verboten, forbidden, even if it would not affect another people. Even one inch of Jewish sovereignty, and even if it wouldn't be in Palestine, was always clearly understood and taught by our rabbis universally. That's one of the basics of Judaism. We're in exile, and we are not to have Jewish sovereignty. And even though, as I say, we went through the Inquisition, Crusades, all this terrible time, still in all the Jewish people, they asked their rabbis, and it's clearly written in books, the rabbis always responded that God has compassion. Don't, you know, he's watching, he's feeling suffering, he watches the human beings that he created, and he's watching us, and he sees our suffering, but the right time will come, he will end exile. And the Jews respected this and never made a state. Zionism started around 100 years ago, 130 years ago, and that turns it on its head. You know, they, so they're
Weiss,
coming totally...
Can I interrupt just a minute, please? Just to... this is so much for people to take in that I think it's nice now and then we'll slow it down and get into some of the points so that people that are new to this can follow it. So just to sum up, I think what you've said is... in fact, very clearly, but the view that you hold and seems to have been really the majority view among observant Jews for probably the 2,000 years was, according to your view, the Jewish diaspora was decreed by God. It was God that dispersed Jews from the Holy Land because, now this is the part I'd like you to clarify a little bit. Why was that? Was that because... at that time, there was not sufficient holiness among the population that was there? Had they violated some commandments? If so, which ones?
Right.
So if you could tell me that, and also tell me which religious texts that you're basing this on. Is this from the Torah, or is this from the Talmud, or is it from elsewhere?
Right, okay. The issue is that, as I say, God is the master of the universe. And every place you have to serve him, but it's considered like the Holy Land, as I say, God's garden or something. In other words, a holy land. We believe that it has a unique holiness to it. And when we were required, when we left Egypt, to go up to the Holy Land, we were warned that you have to be on a special holy level of spirituality, a higher level of spirituality. And in the Torah, it's replete with verses like that, be careful that the land should not reject you if you will defile the land. In other words, we consider it's like, just like a body is a very delicate thing. If you put a drop of sand in an eye, it starts blinking and tearing. And, you know, the body does not take a foreign object. We believe the concept of the Holy Land has special, unique holiness. We have, in fact, many, many laws that in the Torah tells us that we have to give a tenth of what grows in the field before we're able to eat from the land. We have to take and give it to charity, or else it's forbidden for us to eat from the fruits of the land, and so forth. That's replete in the Torah, many, many verses that the land will reject you. And if anybody just looks at throughout the prophets, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, it's all full of that, how the prophets are warning the Jewish people that they will be driven from the land if they will not uphold this. And Jeremiah, we see how Jews were driven from the land because we were not on that holiness. So even though Jews, the many who served God, you know, with holiness, but they weren't on that high level that was necessary, and they were driven from the land. Now, the verse that warns us about returning to that's unique in that it mentions that we were put under the oath of not attempting to end the exile and not returning in mass and so forth. That is from Shir HaShirim. That's the Song of Songs of King Solomon, which although he was before. We were driven into exile. He was the one who built the temple, actually, the first temple. There were two that were destroyed, and the first was his. But he wrote a book called Song of Songs of King Solomon. It's all written in parable, in a metaphor, for people to be able to understand the concept. So it's written in a metaphor. And there's a verse that gets repeated three times, basically. And it says, I've put you under oath, the daughters of Jerusalem, with the deer and the buck of the field, if you will awaken my love prematurely. And that's the translation. It means, I put you under oath, the daughters of Jerusalem. Our rabbis explain in the Talmud, and by the way, the Talmud gets a very bad rap, but again, maybe later in the program we can talk about that, but basically Judaism is, like I said, a covenant that we made to serve, that we made with God on Mount Sinai, which Moses took down the five books from God, which is, says the 613 commandments. But it's written in very, very terse and concise form, and it doesn't explain the commandments. And we believe that orally God explained that to Moses. And later, that was written in the form of the Talmud. So any Jew who says that he does not uphold, he only follows the written book, or the the Bible, the five books of Moses, and not the Talmud, he's not a religious Jew. It's not possible to divide the two, because the Talmud it's 20 volumes, but it's replete. It explains all the commandments, and it's integral. It's the basics of Judaism. And again, it happens to be that it's full of also like the discussions of the rabbis in their study halls, but it's replete and full of punishing words to the Jewish people, like 20 volumes. And it's like it says in the Talmud, if you're not, it's called Talmud Bavli, basically. That means the Talmud, the study of this holy book, that was written in Bavli, in Babylon, which is today Iraq, but it was written at that time, it was Babylon. And over there, it says, like just one example, it says that if you will not, if you're not living in the Holy Land, it's like you're serving idols. And this was written by the rabbis who are living in Iraq or Babel at the time. So I'm just saying, it has to be understood. You can't take statements out of its context. But basically, the point is, again, let me use, because it's, like I say, we want to be able to not confuse people. The Torah is what we are all about. Judaism means nothing else but subservience to God by following the Torah, and Zionism came along 150 years ago, relatively new movement, because Judaism is 3,000 years, and they're totally turning our religion on its head. They made an ersatz Judaism. We are forbidden to make our own sovereignty, our own country, our own nationhood, and Zionism is totally that. It's turning from a spirituality, religion, to serve God, into a nationalism, a base material concept of nationalism, and that we should have. What are we all about? That we have a football team, we have a Olympic team, we have a strong army, and we're proud, and they have the national anthem, and all of this is totally in contradiction to what Judaism is. Now, we left one basic issue I left out of the whole conversation till now, and that is, that we were talking about, if they would try to create a state, all the rabbinical authorities were opposed to this, even though they didn't know that it will affect other people. Because, let's say, if the Zionists wanted to make their state in a barren and a desolate and an uninhabited land, we would still be opposed to it. But they decided to create their Zionist state in Palestine. Reason being, actually, in the first meetings that they had in Basel, Switzerland, in the 1890s, and they were thinking of creating a fruitful and a rich land like Uganda, in Patagonia, next to Argentina, because they were looking at that was in those days, in the beginning of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, in that time period, the end. You looked for a land that you'd be able to have a rich a land to cultivate. So they were thinking of doing it there, but the only reason they changed their minds was because they were looking at, for practical reasons, that they needed a massive support to create a country. You have to have massive backing, a lot of infusion of a great amount of money. So therefore, they decided they're going to make their state in Palestine, because they'll be able to speak to the evangelistic Christians and to the many Jews who don't know their religion, and they'll be able to say, "Oh, you see, God promised the children of Israel the land of Israel, and you should support us for sentimental reasons, or religious reasons, because after all, it's the godly promised land to the children of Israel." So in that way, they were going to dupe people on a colossal level,
And to interrupt briefly, but I'd like to draw people's attention to your website that has a lot of this information and a very interesting book on it. The website is N as in Netra, or Netre, I guess it said, N as in Nancy, KUSA.org. And on there, there's a book that it looks like you can read for free online called The Rabbis Speak Out. which is 130-year record of religious Jewish opposition to Zionism, which is what you're talking about now, that there were rabbis. Well, what you're saying now is probably very new to most of, you know, to many listeners and to many people in the United States today who have been convinced that this is a Jewish religious position and that's where Zionism came from. But as you're explaining, religious Jews and rabbis spoke out really very strongly against it for a long time. And your book has quite a few very powerful quotes from religious rabbis and religious leaders 100 years ago and, you know, 130 years ago and since, opposing Zionism with the types of statements you're making now were really very frequent. It seems to me they were quite common at that time. Is that correct?
That is totally correct. In fact, universally, there was a handful of rabbis who stood on the side of Zionism, who supported it. And usually, I mean, nobody could refute that. That book just doesn't speak about only these rabbis, but the point is that these are the leading Torah authorities, the leading Jewish authorities around the world that we took to write about. But there was, of course, the tens of thousands of other rabbis around the world. Everybody, anybody who became a Zionist was ostracized from the Jewish religious communities because simply it's antithetical to Judaism. Like I've explained, again, we're in exile. This is the concept, it's the basics of religiosity, of Judaism, that God, and we pray in all our prayers. Anybody could read out the prayers of Jewish, the Jewish prayers in English, where we speak about constantly we yearn what we're lacking. Since the destruction of the temple 2,000 years ago, is the closeness to God we feel, not the material piece of land. We're lacking our we had a, Jewish is our connection, a covenant with God to be close to God. And our closeness to God was accomplished on the greatest level by being in going to the temple and serving God there. Now, being that we were driven from there, so we're basically, we lost that closeness to God and what we yearn for. And what Judaism, the main theme of Judaism is that we yearn for that closeness to God, that as I said, it's like a punishment of God because we were not on that high level that we had to be, and we yearn, we have to repent and try to build to, that God should, with his compassion, bring us back. And that will happen, I say, at the end of time, with his miraculous change where all the world will recognize one God. That's what we believe. So what we yearn and pray for is this closeness. And we've been doing this for 2,000 years. And again, the attempt to just simply pick yourself up and move back there because you have, we have airplanes or some other issue is ridiculous because that wasn't, you're missing the whole point. It's not the physical lacking of a piece of land. We never looked at the reason when we were driven from the land by the Romans or the Greeks. In all our prayers, we said, because we say in our prayers, every and other holidays, and we say, "Mipnei chataeinu galinu miartzeinu." That's how our prayers is. And it says, meaning, because of our sins, we were driven from the land. That's a basic of any religious Jew. Nobody thought for a second that the problem was we were physically lacking in strength, and the solution is if we'll get a Uzi or we're going to get some arrow shield, whatever. All the, you know, all the bombers, and then we've found the solution, because there's nothing to do with the physical issue that we can shoot ourselves out. It's this godly decreed exile, and the solution is only returning when God wills it, and the way is through repentance. It's a spiritual problem, and Zionism turns it on its head. These people were non-religious. They had total disdain and detested the Jewish religion. And they came along with another concept. They wanted to have the cake and eat it. In other words, they didn't want to practice the religion Judaism, yet they wanted to be respected in their old communities where they walked around the world between Jewish people and say, "Hey, we're your hero, and you know, we're the great Jews." So they came along and played on that sentiment, on the hurt of Jews, you know, that we're in lands and that we're suffering. So they say, "Oh, you know, you constantly pray to return to the land." Well, the dream has, and you know, you can even hear it on a lot of times on advertisements, Zionist advertisement. They play this, this, you know, slow music that's playing on the emotions and saying, 2,000 years we were driven from the land, and now we're returning to the land. It's, you know, we finally got the state of Israel. Totally, it's abhorrent, because they've totally cut out the soul of the whole concept of Judaism. So they have this facade that they call Judaism. So they've hijacked the name Judaism. They've hijacked the symbols, the Star of David and the menorah, and they're using all of this to further their ambition, a flawed political ambition, and they know they could count on the ignorance of unfortunately the majority of Jews who do not know their religion. They don't practice, they don't keep the Ten Commandments, they don't keep the Sabbath, and they can build on that. And then they had enough money to be able to buy some bad apples to get some rabbis to back them. But in its entirety, the Jewish communities who are religious, with all the rabbis, stood in opposition from day one, vociferous opposition, as you see in that book. Now, again, I want to again reiterate how this is all, even if it wouldn't have affected another people, but part of the Torah, maybe half of the Torah, is talking about how one should, these laws that pertain to how we keep the Sabbath, you know, that has to do with us, with our Maker, with the Almighty. And then there's laws that pertain how God wants us to live with other human beings, not to steal, not to kill, you know, to be kind. That we say, just as God is compassionate, you must be compassionate. We have to emulate God. And here they're creating a state by uprooting another people, stealing their land, and all the terrible litany of crimes that they've done to the Palestinian people in the name of our religion. So it makes the crime, in multitudes, it compounds this crime, what they're doing, of creating this rebellion against God, of trying to return to the land when God put us under oath not to, and they picked Palestine, as I say, because of the name Israel, in the Holy Land, and they ignoring that we're not allowed to return there as a nation, and ignoring all the laws of the Torah, not to kill and not to steal. So it's from every facet, this concept of Zionism is totally contradictory to everything what Judaism is, and it makes the crime even worse. So I'd like to add that Muslim countries throughout history was a safe haven for Jews, and they embraced us. They opened their arms and took in the Jewish people when we suffered in Europe many times through different trials and tribulations, like the Inquisition and Crusades and different things. And the Muslim countries took us in, and even though we were distinctly different in our practice and our religion, because we're Judaism and not Islam, and there was no human rights groups or United Nations to protect us, and the Islamic countries, we flourished. Anybody can look with his own eyes. You can go to the Islamic countries. I was in Egypt. You can go to Iran. You can go to Tunisia, Morocco, and all of them. And you will find that you can see that the Jewish communities flourished with great rabbis who were distinctly Jewish and practicing the religion, and we were not massacred. Were there bumps in the road? Yes. There was occasionally bumps in the road. But as a general rule, we were able to coexist and babysit each other's children in Palestine as one of these countries, which the vast majority were Muslim. We have people today, as from other Arab countries and Muslim countries, they can tell you anecdotes, whether it's Muslims or Christians or Jews, who we have in our communities today, and some of them who come out to the demonstrations with us, who are in the 70s and 80s, and they lived together in total harmony in the old city, in the same courtyard, babysat each other's children, the most precious object that a person can have, a precious possession that a person has, babysat each other's children when the fathers went to, the mothers had to go to pray in Yom Kippur, and all the women went to pray. Who did they turn to? The Arab and Muslim neighbors to babysit their children. This is how was a basic, a human coexistence without a harmonic coexistence. And the Zionists, all of a sudden, take this issue and try to turn the history on its head, because they, up till now, you didn't have internet and all those things, till like 50 years ago, and they try to sell a story that it was a land without a people, for a people without a land. But basically, what I was saying is that the Jewish people have a special requirement, not only not to steal, not to kill, but to show, we're required to show gratitude for good done to us. And the Muslim and Arab countries were tremendously good to us. And how dare they now do this terrible, commit this, perpetrate this crime against these people who we ought to show, on the contrary, help them. And so it's really for us, we are frustrated and humiliated, but what is being done in the name of Judaism, in our name? And therefore, as you say, the rabbis speak out. We have other books, the historic documents you can find on our site, to show how when they try to create the state, the chief rabbi of Palestine pleaded with the United Nations, Rabbi Dashinsky of blessed memory, approached the representatives of the United Nations, and he said, we furthermore wish to express our definite opposition to a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. I'm quoting him. And this is all there in the records, the United Nations records. And yet the Jewish community, besides that the Muslim and the Christian communities were ignored, the Jewish community that was living there for hundreds of years was totally ignored, and they created this Zionist creation. The British actually gave it the right, as you know, the Balfour Declaration and so forth. They gave them the right to exist because they were the Britain, of course, had the mandate, and they gave them the first control over there, because the ones who created Zionism was from Vienna, Austria, and were in Britain. There was Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel, and he had helped the Britain by the World War I, and they promised them a gift, and he said he wanted them to help him with the state. And therefore, they gave him this Balfour Declaration and so forth. But this was not, and so it was rammed down the throats of not only the Muslim community, but the Jewish community residing in Palestine. Until today, if you will go to any of in the major religious communities, really contrary to the popular belief, the more the religious the community, the more anti-Zionist. In other words, it's a very religious community. If you go to Meir Sharim and to Jerusalem, the center where they're very religious, or you will go to Stamford Hills in England, in London, England, that's the most religious Jewish community. Or you come to New York. Anybody who wants to come to New York, right across from Manhattan, there's Williamsburg, Brooklyn. If you have to, you go over the Williamsburg Bridge, you make a right, you ride into the most concentrated religious Jewish area, and you can go for miles. There's not one, and you see, it's like you're stepping back in time, because everybody dresses the women dress modestly, the men go, you know, with beards and so forth, and you will find that there's not one single Israeli flag flying there. And how could that be? They're very fervent religious. You would think that, of course, they would be supportive of this dream called the Zionist State of Israel. Yet you find on the contrary. Because they're very religious, they oppose in its essence the creation of the State of Israel, not because the problem or that problem, because the concept of making a state lies in the face of Judaism. The concept of stealing the land from the Palestinians, the whole idea of Zionism and the Zionist state is simply a hijacked Judaism, and they have no right to speak in the name of Judaism. And when they refer to the ones who stand up in opposition as anti-Semitic, it's a simple ploy. It's a mode of attack, you know, that they've been able to use in order to silence and to intimidate people who want to stand up for what's right. And the more the religious, the more we stand up against that. And if you call us anti-Semitic, so you see how ridiculous that is.
That's right. It's very interesting, because your position does seem to be very much in line with traditional Judaism as it was practiced for many centuries, and certainly in the lead up to with the implementation of political Zionism, there was great opposition by the Jewish community in Palestine itself, as you've just described. I've been at some Zionist conferences that talked about how they were able to overcome the opposition of the Jewish population in Palestine itself, and we're very proud of having done that. So your position is really much more in line with what has been the position for a long time, it seems. But it's certainly, in today's world, a very unusual one for most people to hear. And it seems quite a courageous position, because certainly you're demonized for that. I believe the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, has some pages accusing you and criticizing your activities. In Israel itself, I've seen some videos of people that are part of this religious opposition to Zionism being beaten pretty viciously for their putting that position. I've heard that at your rally, some of your rallies in New York City, for example, opposing Israel, that people will spit at some of your members for taking this religious position. It must be very difficult to continue doing this kind of work and trying to stay true to what you feel is religiously required of you. Are there times you just have doubts about that, or have you lost members because of it is so difficult and you are under such widespread attack?
Yeah, that's a very strong point, and it's very, unfortunately, very true. If you go to our site, nkusa.org, and as you say, Nancy, nkusa.org, you will find, and there's links, you find many sites, you find that that the Jewish people, since day one, I mean like over 100 years already, Jews have been assassinated for standing up, simply not physically, you know, not carrying any type of arms or any type of, you know, weapons or whatever, simply for speaking out against Zionism. Our rabbis have been assassinated. Maybe the first famous martyr was in the 1924. His name was Dr. Dahan, who became religious. He was from Denmark. He was a famous orator, a diplomat, and they even made a statue for him in Denmark. And then he decided to become religious. He was affected by some anti-Semitic slurs he heard, and it's like gave him a shock. And he decided to become religious. He went to Jerusalem, thinking that most probably, like the common the feelings is that to become Jewish, he's going to support the Zionist movement. And he went to the Palestine, and he was a very serious person. And he saw that the heads of the Jewish religious the heads of the Jewish community, the religious Jews, the rabbis, were anti-Zionist. So at the beginning, when he arrived, he was connected. He became close with the Zionist leaders. But almost immediately after that, he was a very serious person searching the truth, and he realized that the rabbinical authorities and the ones who were really representing the Jewish community, they were anti-Zionist. And he said, listen, he became close with them, and he became their, he saved them from the Britain at the beginning after the First World War, insisted that every Jew has to register, mind you, under the Zionist offices. And it was crazy, and the Jews didn't know how to oppose this. They didn't have power. They were not both not militant and not, you know, politically connected or anything. And what they wanted, of course, that the Muslims should go through their leaders, and the Jewish leaders, they decided de facto the Zionists are the leaders of Jews. So he was the one, his name, Dr. Dahan, of blessed memory, stood up, and he was able to protect the Jews and get that we didn't have to register with the Zionists. But afterwards, he decided he's going to go to British Parliament and present the case of the Jews into Parliament. And the Zionists, the Haganah, warned him. They warned him they're going to kill him. And they assassinated, Haganah assassinated him cold-bloodedly in front of the hospital in Jerusalem called Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. It's in their records. This is a fact. And this is 1924. And since then, Jews, till today, are constantly beaten. They're killed. They use different methods in the last, let's say, 30, 40 years, whatever. It would be a scandal if they would be shooting live ammunition. So they use rubber truncheons with lead in the middle, that they have internal bleeding and beaten, and people get it was probably not a teenager in the very religious community was not arrested at least once, you know. And so this is a very sad story. And more than that, around the world, we have, let's say here in New York, we have tremendously large demonstrations, or we went to Washington D.C. when President Obama took up Netanyahu, their prime minister. And it was tens of thousands of people demonstrating. And it never, never gets reported in the mainstream media because there's the intimidation. But they don't report these. You can look at our sites. You can see the tremendously large demonstrations that we have in New York annually, a few times a year, in front of the Israeli embassy, demonstrating against them. Tens of thousands of Jews, yet it doesn't get reported. But if the Zionists make demonstrations, it does. Now, what the result of that, of course, is that people don't know the fact that there's so many Jews And in fact, you can say the core of the religion of Judaism is opposed to Zionism. But more than that is also the Zionists, unfortunately, although I accuse them of being, you know, the movement is evil and that what they're doing is totally illegitimate and wrong according to God and Torah, what people call human rights, we call godliness, it's totally against God, yet at the same time, you can't accuse them of being inefficient. So they have, let's say they have AIPAC, you know, the American Israeli Political Alliance Committee or whatever, what they do is that they intimidate, as you know, let's say any politician who dares to show too much sympathy for the Palestinian people. So he's committing a political assassination. He's killing himself actually. You know, And many, you know, Paul Finley, congressman, wrote a book about that, and many others can tell you that. So, they're committing suicide. It's really political suicide if they do that, if they stand up in opposition. And therefore, so what happens to a few, they target any politician who stands up in opposition, and other politicians see this and they say, you know, I want to do good, and many politicians may mean to do well, but they decide that, you know, they're going to lose, they have ambitions to do a lot of good, so they decide that it's worth it not to touch this subject, rather than that they shouldn't destroy themselves entirely. You know, they come with a person always makes compromises in one's issues because, you know, you feel you have to accomplish other issues, you're not going to lose everything. And the same thing is with the newspapers. The media is afraid to touch this. They have media watch. If anybody dares show too many times sympathy for the Palestinians or would show our demonstrations to, whatever, then so they'll be committing, then they get threatened. They get targeted, they get threatened that they're going to, they say, they contact them and they say, we're going to contact all your advertisers, you know, the people who advertise in your newspaper or whatever the publication or whatever, you know, the media is, the media outlet, and you're going to lose your business. It's going to go down the drain. So people are afraid to touch it. The same thing is with Jews. The Jewish people around America, and I mean, I have first-hand knowledge of this. I'm in touch with people. If anybody dares, they see that when Jews speak up against Zionism, in the Holy Land, they get brutally beaten, arrested, and nobody speaks about it. It doesn't get covered. It's like nothing happened. But around the world, and here in the United States, if somebody speaks up against Zionism, they get targeted. They get threatened. Sometimes it's physical threats, and other times they harass. They harass by making them uncomfortable wherever they go, and they come along. They're brazen. They come in your face. They take pictures of everybody, video pictures and so forth, and wherever we're standing demonstrating, they look for certain people who are working in certain businesses, and then they contact the business and say that they, if they're not going to fire them, they're going to see that they shouldn't have any, no other business will do business. You know, they're very efficient, unfortunately.
Another,
so people are afraid to speak up.
That's right.
You know,
I think
so people are basically afraid to speak up against them. You know, what I'm saying is that people are afraid.
Right.
They see this, what happens to people who do speak out. And you would have hundreds of thousands, I think, who would be standing out in the street demonstrating in many other parts of the United States. In many other states, I know for a fact, in other cities, they're very strongly anti-Zionist, many of them, and they would be speaking out, but they're afraid because they'll be targeted. In New York, we have this tremendously large community. We're insulated. And one of the great rabbis was the chief rabbi of Palestine, who came to the United States around 40 years ago, whatever, Rabbi Teitelbaum of blessed memory, and he insisted that his students stand up and speak out. And at the cost of their lives, he said, we have to let the world know that it's not Judaism, it's Zionism. They're two diametric opposites. They don't represent our religion and not the ones who are true to the religion. So many, you know, we have many followers, yeah, and they live in New York or other concentrated religious areas and speak out.
One question that we only have, it looks like, less than 10 minutes left. I have a lot of questions, but one of them I'm curious about is that you are clearly a deeply anti-Zionist organization, both theologically and philosophically and in your actions. To what degree have you been able to work with other groups within the Palestine Solidarity Movement? For example, Jewish Voice for Peace, the Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, a different organization, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Are you connected with those groups? Have you been welcomed, or have you been able to coordinate your activities with Jewish Voice for Peace, for example?
Well, basically, we have been standing from, thank God, I would say, you know, myself, I'm hitting 60 with God's help, and I've been sitting, standing with over 30 years, and I remember my as a teenager still in our schools that they took us out to demonstrate, so therefore we were standing, and we never actually had, we would be standing there alone as religious Jewish, you know, Jews standing by the United Nations, which we go frequently in front of the United Nations and demonstrate, and we would be standing there alone. Then I think by the attack on Lebanon was the first time, I think, basically that we saw an Arab Muslim presence that came out to the United Nations. They were suspicious of us. They couldn't figure this out. How could that be? Jews are standing. And then they came over to us, and since then, since they showed their presence, we've been demonstrating together and, you know, marching together with the Palestinian people to make a statement clearly that the right is that there should be, with God's help, an entirely free Palestine under Palestinian rule. You know, it's under the people of the land. It's their land, and that the Jewish, and we fly Palestinian flags with them, and we say, you know, this is what the Torah expects of us, that we are forbidden to have our sovereignty and not allowed to steal and kill on the contrary. So we march together, and we go with many, many groups of the Palestinian Muslim communities, for instance, Al-Auda, or whatever it was, you know, the many different AMP, all the different Muslim, you know, groups that, and Arab groups that are standing there marching, or human rights groups that go out there. We go out and we demonstrate. We try to go to Arab and Muslim countries and, you know, meet with their leaders. We're apolitical, so we have nothing, you know, although it's sometimes uncomfortable, you know, there's the different, unfortunately, you know, the different conflicts between in Shiite, Sunni, and all the different unfortunate problems. But we go to Iran, we go to the Muslim countries, to the Sunni countries. We went to Gaza through, we have many people living in the Holy Land under Israeli occupation. So we try to, and they would all embrace us, all whether it's you know, from in Gaza, or whether it's President Abbas, or whoever it would be, all the groups, or whether it's you know, they all embrace us because they know we do not, and the point is that we don't have a religious conflict, so they're all there to embrace us. Now, we have a point as Orthodox Jews that we do not make with non-Orthodox different forms of religion, that we cannot, that was a fatwa issued 200 years ago, that we do not work with other affiliated, you know, non-religious affiliated groups. But that said, when we demonstrate and the other people come along and demonstrate, you know, with the Palestinian people and so forth, and therefore we have the same demonstrations and so forth, that they're coming along and we're going on the same demonstrations. So we do have, and we meet many people who are, you know, they're not anti our religion or whatever, so they come along, you know, we stand together, we have these demonstrations. So we are affiliated in that manner. But basically, as I say, we have no problem because of going with, you know, with the human rights and the Muslim communities, and we go to their communities and to their centers and try to bridge this.
We've run out of time. There's so much more I was hoping we could get into. I'm sure you'll be on the show again sometime. I encourage people to go to the website that you have. It's full of information, excellent books and quotes that will inform people about the viewpoint of Naturae Carta. The website is nkusa.org. Thank you so much for being on the show and for taking the stance that you've taken, despite a great deal of very dangerous opposition at times. I know that sometimes, yeah, I think one of your synagogues was burned down several years ago. So I don't think anybody should underestimate the kind of courage it takes for you to be a public spokesperson saying what you're saying.
Right.
So thank you for being on the show.
I must say that, whenever we met you through the years, you were always extremely, extremely friendly, and so the attacks that on you that you're anti-Jewish, we definitely didn't see that. And that being maligned is nothing unusual of what the Zionists do. This is not, unfortunately, no time left, but they've done it to us, and totally falsely you know, put statements that never happened and never was. So I'm sure that's the case. And we urge everybody that to pray to God for the speedy and total and peaceful dismantlement of this impediment to peace, the cause of bloodshed and hate and mistrust, the existence of the Zionist state of Israel, so we can live together once again and we can show as Jews our appreciation for the Muslim people and give them a free rule over the land, their respect and so forth, and that we can show to all the Muslim and Arab countries our and not be intimidated. You're not anti-Semitic if you're anti-Zionist, and on the contrary, the Zionist.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.